This week, both Vice President Kamala Harris and Donald Trump's running mate J.D. Vance visited Indiana. Harris's visit was planned before President Joe Biden's announcement Sunday that he would be dropping from the presidential race and endorsing Harris as the Democratic Party nominee. Harris spoke to a crowd of thousands of black women at the Zeta Phi Beta sorority's Grand Boulé Wednesday. She touched on accomplishments of the Biden administration. J.D. Vance also visited Indiana on Wednesday for fundraising in Fort Wayne. The event organizer told local media the event raised nearly $1 million toward his campaign. The Trump campaign filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission that said Harris's campaign was improperly taking over President Biden's campaign funds. This week on Noon Edition, we'll talk with political experts about expectations leading up to November and developments on both parties' tickets. Right after this hour's news.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.
Welcome to Noon Edition on WFIU. I'm your host, Bob Salzberg, co-hosting today with Lori McRobbie. We're talking with our guests about changes in the Democratic Party ticket for the presidency and also visits of J.D. Vance and Kamala Harris to Indiana this week and just everything, all the wild stuff that's going on in politics right now. We're trying to get a connection with one of our guests right now, but we do have a couple of guests with us at this moment. Brian Howey from Howey Politics, Indiana, also which is affiliated with State Affairs, is here, and also Fabio Rojas, the IU Virginia L. Roberts Professor of Sociology and Department Chair. Sorry, I had to get that one out. So he's with the Sociology Department. They are both joining us right now. We're trying to get Steve Shine, who is the Republican Party Chair in Allen County, to talk with us for a little bit of the program. He could be here for the first half, but we're having trouble making a connection. And then the second half of the program, we'll be joined by Stacey Grant, who is the 26th International President of Zeta Phi Beta Sorority. She was responsible for inviting Kamala Harris and getting Kamala Harris to Indianapolis this week. So we've got a lot of people to talk to. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call at 812-855-0811 in Bloomington or toll-free at 1-877-285-9348. You can also send questions to the show to news@indianapublicmedia.org. So thank you. We're hoping to get everybody on today, but I'm going to start with Fabio Rojas and Brian Howey. We can sort of set the stage for this crazy political season. Fabio, as a professor of sociology, you've studied voter behaviors and you've studied a lot of polling. I mean, have you seen anything like this year?
Right. So this is really unprecedented in American history. It is very rare for a president to resign or give up a campaign for president this close to the election. The last time anything happened like this was 1968 with Lyndon B. Johnson after he lost the New Hampshire primary. And there was a lot of pressure on him to stop campaigning because of the Vietnam War. Also, a lot of what we know about polls and where the election might be going is based on the last 10 or 20 or 30 years of presidential campaigns. So we don't have any data about what happens when somebody steps aside and a vice president comes in. And, of course, there's always the Trump factor. He's a very unique person.
Right. Brian Howey from Indiana, Howey Politics, Indiana. So this week we had both J.D. Vance, the vice presidential candidate on the Republican side, and Kamala Harris, the vice president of the United States, who is now the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party in Indiana. Indiana is not really in play in this election, I don't think. So why were people attracted to come here?
Well, the vice president showed up to address one of the Divine Nine sororities and raised money. And then J.D. Vance was in Fort Wayne also raising money, did not make any public appearances. And that's kind of a twist. It used to be, you know, a candidate would come to a media market and would want to appear before the TV cameras and that kind of thing. And that's no longer the case. So,
all right. Steve Shine, do we finally have you?
I hope so. Can you hear me?
I can, yes. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you. What a small world. I was telling your producer, not only do I know your brother, not only am I good friends with Brian Howie since the early 90s, but also I began my college broadcast career on WFIU in 1971.
Right. Well, we are happy to have you back. So thanks very much for being here. So Steve Shine is the Allen County Republican Party chair, and he does have a lot of history in radio and in the media. So, Steve, I want to ask you about J.D. Vance's visit to Fort Wayne. Was that planned before he got the vice presidential nod?
Yes and no. Many people thought that, or the organizers thought that President Trump would announce his selection prior to the convention, and thus whomever that would have been scheduled to come into Fort Wayne on or about July the 9th. But the Trump media people decided to let the Biden cognitive issues play out without interfering from distracting from that by announcing a vice presidential candidate. So basically they let that story of the potential at that time resignation from the ballot to play out and then waited until the convention. So it was planned. It was supposed to be before the convention, but since the announcement of the vice president selection was not made until the first day, which was July 15th, it was then scheduled for a week afterwards.
All right. I want to follow up on that and just ask, how has J.D. Vance's addition to the ballot, how is it playing in Fort Wayne and Allen County and as far as you can tell through the rest of Indiana?
Well, of course, my circle of friends are mostly Republicans.
Right.
It has played very well with them. They find him a fresh new face, a conservative voice, someone who represents pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and making something out of yourself after having suffered the worst possible conditions being brought up as a child. Having gone to from that and through Yale Law School was quite an accomplishment, and they find that he's a very acceptable person. As I said earlier today on another interview, the bench for President Trump to select from was quite deep. J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, the governor of North Dakota, he was also a possible contender. So it was quite a selection process, but I think everyone is very pleased with J.D. Vance.
I just let me sort of follow up on that and maybe get some comments as well from our other guests. Perhaps as a female, but I think this is true for a number of people, the issue of reproductive rights is very powerful in this campaign in general. J.D. Vance has made some fairly, I would say, very conservative comments about the role of women, and as well as a particular stance on abortion. And certainly, you know, people are entitled to believe what they would like to believe, but it does resonate in different ways with the voting public. And I'm just curious about, I think there was at least some of the comments that I heard from people was that for President Trump to perhaps take away what might be an advantage for a Democratic candidate, Biden, now Harris, he might have thought about picking someone who might balance out some of that issue. I'm just curious, and Fabio, maybe actually all of you might be able to comment on that. How do you see that issue playing out now that Vance is on the ticket?
Well, one thing we could talk about a little bit is how much does the vice presidential nominee actually matter to most voters?
Mm.
So often in the media, we think that there's a huge amount of attention given to vice presidential candidates. But honestly, how many people sat around and thought about Dan Quayle or Dick Cheney, you know, in their spare time? Most voters are very interested in which party we're talking about because partisan identification is super strong in this country right now. And they care a lot about who's on the top of the ticket. And traditionally, we think that most vice presidential candidates don't swing the election that much, with the possible exception if a vice president is from a swing state that happens to be close. So here, this is a little bit puzzling from a strategic perspective, because even though he doubles down on the abortion issue for the Republican Party, so that gets the base a little bit more energized, but he comes from a state which is currently polling a +7 for Trump right now, and that's Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Brian, your thoughts?
Well, yeah. It seems to me like the Trump campaign is wanting to gin up its base, you know, it's white rural males. And I think Vance, you know, plays well to that crowd. The fascinating thing to me is that this election may be, you know, determined by the suburban educated female voter. And I don't think that J.D. Vance is going to play very well to that group. So, you know, it depends on, I guess, what the campaign priorities are. Trump has not really looked to make, you know, inroads outside the MAGA base at this point.
Steve, can you respond to that? You know, you are in the middle of it as the Allen County Republican Party chair. How is the what are the demographics of the party and the support for Trump in Allen County and other parts of the state that you know about?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm in the middle of it. I'd say I'm in the right of it, actually, with the thoughts of people up here. This is solid Trump country. It's just amazing. In fact, just yesterday, there was a news story that one of the private contractors who lease the electronic signs on the interstates where they have road construction, like, you know, watch your speed limit, and they count down what the speed limit is, and they say lane closure, et cetera. That information had been replaced by one of their employees that says, vote Trump 2024. As people drove down the highway. Of course, that lasted for about 2 minutes before a complaint was made to the state about it. But it just shows you the lengths that people will go to show support for Donald Trump. It's solid Trump country here. This third district, of which Allen County is part of, is one of the most Republican congressional districts in the United States. And just answering something to what Brian said, who I always enjoy reading his report, his Holly political report, is that I don't think President Trump was going to select anyone who would alienate the very, very hardcore solid base that he has with regard to the right to life group. Compromising that could have led to a fracturing of some of his support, and it's going to be a close election. And if it's a close election, there's no need to put somebody on the ballot who seems to balance out, but yet someone who will maintain the solidarity of the philosophy that is the linchpin of the Republican Party.
So sort of kind of staying with the pick of J.D. Vance, but also another issue in the campaign, of course, has been the age of the candidates. And now we have one who is now the oldest candidate for the office of president in American history and, you know, has also been someone who's, I think, fair to say, has had some challenges speaking unscripted. As certainly as President Biden has had as well. But J.D. Vance, obviously, I'm not even sure he's 40, but maybe he's about that. He's obviously next generation.
39.
Well, there you go. Yes. So to what extent, and Brian, you might want to take this one, is to what extent do you think that may have also factored into the choice of Vance, and to what extent do you think that's going to balance things out?
Well, one thing, I think it was Donald Trump Jr. and Steve's congressman, Jim Banks, that were the biggest advocates for Vance joining the ticket. Am I correct in that, Steve?
Oh, absolutely, you were correct. In fact, on the day that J.D. Vance was selected as vice president, it was Jim Banks who introduced J.D. Vance to the delegates, not at the convention, but in gatherings around Milwaukee.
Okay.
So
I would like to point one other thing out. I was just doing some math here while everyone was talking. Basically, the Republicans have it the best of both worlds. They have the oldest and the youngest. And when you add 78 to 39, you get 117. Divide that by two. So the average age of our combined ticket is 58 years. And I think that's pretty good.
Well, I had read that one of the reasons for adding J.D. Vance was to try to convince the base, the core group of voters that are supporting Donald Trump, that the movement will not end if Donald Trump doesn't run again, and that this is here to stay. Steve, reaction to that?
Well, I think if the Republicans are looking for a younger candidate or a youth on the ticket, it's not just on youth. It's also based on the philosophy of the candidate. And I don't know. I like having J.D. Vance on the ticket because of his age, but I'm not sure that many of his beliefs are embraced by some of the younger voters. Now, that's not to say there isn't a large group of right-to-life individuals who are in high school and college and in their early years. But I would say just by the virtue of him being 39 is not sufficient to attract the youth vote.
So the Trump campaign spent, a good part of the first part of the year, castigating President Biden over his age, suggesting he was infirm, incoherent and everything. Do you think that that's a boomerang that's going to come back and catch him from the rear?
Well, I feel you're as young as you feel. And certainly Joe Biden didn't look like he felt very young. Brian, I was in my 30s when you and I met. I am now I'll be 72 in October, and I feel like I did back when you and I met in the early 90s. It's a mindset. And, knock on wood, and thank God I'm not shuffling around. I'm not losing my thought process. None of the things that unfortunately go with the aging process have set in with me at this time. And the only reason why I'm bringing that up is because we have quite a difference. We have President Trump does not at all appear to me to show any of the signs of aging that plagued Joe Biden. Joe Biden couldn't get up and down stairs. He had to be let off the stage. He lost his mind, his mindset when he was speaking. The severity of that was heightened during the debate, which was obviously so bad it sunk his candidacy. So again, you are as young as you feel, and if you don't display the issues which forced Biden off the ticket, I'm not so sure that age itself is that bad. I know people in their 80s who are sharper and as agile as I am. It's just what, our genetics are, what we have inherited in our DNA. And obviously that did not trickle down to Joe Biden.
Steve, we only have you for a few more minutes, But if I could get another question in about former President Trump, he's a different kind of Republican from, you know, you talked about when you first met Brian when you were in your 30s. I mean, the Republican Party has changed dramatically under Trump's flag. Can you address that and express maybe why it's become the party of Trump?
Well, I'll start off by saying the days of Richard Lugar were a lot easier when I was chairman. as Ricky Ricardo said, there was not so much explaining that you have to do as you do today. But I think there has just been an uptick in the populist movement. I think we saw that at the Indiana Republican Convention when people who felt that they had not been heard or listened to and were not part of the power structure had been ignored for years. I think that that explains why our lieutenant governor candidate, Micah Beckwith, did so well, because he appealed to those who felt disenfranchised. And there's a lot of people out there who feel that way, that they have not been listened to, that they have not had input, that they have been overlooked by people who have money and power and access. And I think that many of the Trump supporters come from that ilk, if you will, that they feel that his mantra is very attractive to them because it is so so baseline, if you will, without the ruffles and flourishes that they've been used to hearing with no results. And so that's very attractive to the common man.
All right. Steve Shine is the Allen County Republican Party chair. He has another meeting, something else to do at 12:30. So we're going to let you go, Steve. Really appreciate you being here.
You're very kind. I really appreciate it. Many thanks to your producer for the excellent job that she did. And best of luck to all of you. I'll look forward. Maybe we can do a post-mortem after the November election and see what happens.
Okay.
Plenty to talk about.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Noon Edition today. We're talking about what's going on in politics. There's a lot going on. We have Brian Howie with us from Howie Politics Indiana for State Affairs. And also Fabio Rojas, the IU Virginia L. Roberts Professor of Sociology, Department Chair. He's here with us. And now we're going to be joined by Stacey Grant, the 26th International President of Zeta Phi Beta Sorority. Dr. Grant, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, and I hope that your day is going well. I always say it's good to be above ground and to be seen and not viewed.
Absolutely. So you just had really quite an event in Indianapolis with Vice President Kamala Harris, the presumptive nominee. How did it come about that you got Kamala Harris to join you?
So we're still here in the midst of our national conference that we call Grand Boulet. So we gather every 2 years for our organization. We're 104 years old, founded January 16th, 1920 on the campus of Howard University. And we have over 900 chapters across the globe. And we come together to take care of the service footprint that we've created as a premier service organization and also the bonds of friendship. So with that being said, our theme this year is Finer Women, Amplifying the Extraordinary Power of She, advocating for social justice, health justice, and economic justice globally. So back last year, we had our Zeta Day on the Hill, which is an opportunity for our members to come to the Capitol and meet their Congress leaders, their congressional leaders, and to talk about issues that affect the communities that they serve. We invited our vice president to attend that event, but her schedule did not allow. And we said, well, is there a possibility we could pursue looking at her calendar to come to our convention in July of 2024? So that is a long process because, as you know, the president's schedule, the vice president's schedule is very, very busy. So we weren't sure it would happen, but we continued staying in contact so that we could see if we could be considered for our conference. And lo and behold, we got a call a couple of weeks back saying that it looked like her schedule could work with us. And then we got the call that a press release was going out that our conference was chosen as one of the stops she was making in the month of July. So the excitement in our organization was just beyond control, right? It was like, wait, she actually said yes, she's coming. And I shared that with our membership, we would have a special visit by the Vice President of the United States. Lo and behold, I'm on the ground in Indianapolis preparing our pre-conference information with the hotels and the convention center. And then I hear screams erupt in the room. And I thought something happened to a team member. It was the tweet that went out from the president's office that he was no longer going to pursue being the nominee. So everybody said, wait, what does that mean? Because we didn't know what was coming next. And then what came was the fact that he endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris to run for president. So everything changed in an instant. We already were in conversations with Secret Service to appropriately prepare for the sitting vice president to address our delegation. But once this news hit, it amplified all of the preparations, the meetings, the considerations, the media that wanted to be involved, because history began at the Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated Grand Boule in Indianapolis, Indiana, where this was her first public full appearance talking about what the Biden-Harris administration was able to accomplish and what her vision is for what America can continue to rise to be. So needless to say, I haven't slept well. How about that? It's been just nonstop flurry of activity. And our membership is just excited that we were able to have the chance to have her address us. At the end of the day, we don't tell our members who to vote for or how to vote. That's responsibility. Our responsibility is to educate our members, to mobilize them to get out to vote, to hear from candidates so they can make their choice on what they feel is the best solution for what our country faces in leadership.
Yeah. Dr. Grant, I also wanted to just ask about that because you are you're the sorority that you're head of is has been noted before one of the Divine Nine, and Kamala Harris is not a member of Zeta Phi Beta, but she is, and I'm going to get the Greek letters wrong, but she is a member of another, I believe.
She's a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. There are nine of us who are members of the Divine Nine, and we each have our own rich traditions of over 100 years worth of history. And we have different colors, we have different shields, but we have the same mission. And the mission is all of our founders understood that there was a need to pursue scholarship so that you can have access to opportunities to provide service as your give back for being able to matriculate through college and then to bond together as brothers and sisters. So when we do this work, we do it collectively because we're stronger together. Over 2.5 million of us, any industry you go to, any sports arena, anything that you touch, you are guaranteed to find a member of one of our organizations there. Yeah. So we do friendly little competitions like in college and such.
Sure,
but as we get
sure.
older, we understand there's power in the collective way that we mobilize and educate our communities.
Yeah. And as you know, you're nonpartisan. And so just can you talk a little bit about just preparations that you had to make and how you sort of balance the fact that you hear not only do you have a sitting serving vice president who obviously is affiliated with a particular party, but suddenly becomes a candidate for the highest office in the land. How did you handle the potential partisan nature of her visit?
So we were clear about the fact that she was invited to come to report to our organization on what is important to us. How is this administration answering the call for social justice, health justice, and economic justice? And she addressed that. The areas that this administration has worked to provide answers and solutions, just as any sitting vice president would get that respect. It doesn't mean that all of our members necessarily are Democrats or necessarily want to support a Democratic nominee. What it means is that we did our due diligence in allowing someone to share their thoughts, their vision, and for our members to make their own personal decisions on what they want to do. So we were clear about the fact that this was an opportunity to honor the second highest position in the land coming to our convention. So no matter what your political beliefs are, that is an honor to have of the free world, the second in charge.
Sure.
And then that shift to being a historical first Black female nominee for President of the United States of America. So it was simply an honor to hear from her and to have her present here as the first D9 organization to do that, but bringing in those members from the other organizations who happened to be present. A few of my colleagues who were present, who are presidents, were in the room. And we were just excited to know that we are part of history and we got to host for the world the first view on the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So Brian Howie and Fabio Rojas are both here with us. I would like to ask you about Kamala Harris. Is she going to be able to unify the Democratic Party and continue to build momentum, or is this sort of something that's going to start to dissipate a little bit? Fabio, I know it's an opinion question, not based on your research, but
well, there is research on how presidential campaigns actually evolve over time and how they get momentum, and I think we're already seeing evidence that there is a consolidation. Almost every major Democrat has come out to endorse Vice President Harris. They've already scheduled an online nomination process so that the actual convention for the Democratic Party will be more of a publicity event and a communication event rather than an actual brokered convention like we had in generations past. So we see a lot of evidence that the party is strongly backing Vice President Harris. You may have seen news reports of a $210 million donation push. I'll say that's clearly good. Then you also mentioned, what about dissipation? Well, campaigns have cycles. They have ups and downs. Trump got a little bit ahead of the polls after the Republican convention, after the nomination of J.D. Vance, and that started receding a little bit. And now we're probably going to see the same thing with Kamala Harris, where she's going to build up and then maybe recede a little bit as it sets in that she'll probably be the nominee and it'll be politics as usual.
Okay. Brian, question. I also want to ask you about her ability to affect any down ballot races in Indiana. Yeah. Is there any possibility of that?
Well, do you mind if I ask Dr. Grant
No.
a historical question?
No.
So your organization began in 1920, which I believe was the first election that women were granted
Yes.
the right to vote. Am I correct?
Yes, that sounds about right, if not a year off.
So it was the 1924 election that really brought women fully into the process. So that's what I'm interested in. And that coincided with the election of the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana, one of our darker chapters. I'm just kind of curious as to, did your organization begin with the right to vote? And if you could walk us through a little bit about how that evolved.
Well, we know in the 1920s, it was a interesting time for the entire country. And when you think about African-Americans and their experience and their ability to go to colleges and universities, it wasn't as widespread as it is now. So the mere fact that Howard University was a place where our founders could go and to get an education, they realized that finding some community to help you sustain your process through matriculating through school was essential, and challenging the scholastic efforts and endeavors of the members was something that they were focused on. And then realizing, how do I reach back and give back and stand in the front lines of women having rights and the right to vote being one of them, but just how they were able to get educated, because that was a whole nother mm-hmm. dynamic, that women weren't usually the ones going to get an education and pursuing a career. That was a different paradigm shift. So our founders were at that cutting edge of speaking about the things that weren't normal at that time and advocating that everyone should have access and opportunity, and wanting to have an organization that was predicated on speaking out against the societal ills of the day and finding solutions for them.
Yeah, I actually it's a great question, Brian, and it is interesting. Now we don't need to get too far into the past, so we have a lot to talk about in the present. But Fabio, I'm wondering if some of the look at trends in voting, especially, and let's just say, Black women who are members of the Divine Nine, the strength of the organizations that existed as women gained the franchise. And how that has tracked over time. I think you know, the, you know, I would say black women as a voting cohort have been very strong in the Democratic Party for years. Has that really, has that tracked over time as opposed to other or in addition to other demographic groups?
Yeah, gender is one of those things that does have some predictive power in terms of projecting how a person will vote. But historically, the story is actually a little bit complicated. So in the 1920s, a lot of the progressives, a lot of the suffragists were actually Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Black voters were still in the party of Lincoln at that time. A lot of the politics of the 50s and 60s around segregation and desegregation had not occurred yet. So if we look at this historically, going back to the founding of Zeta Phi Beta and other organizations, I bet the story would be very complicated, that you probably see a lot of Republican activists in that organization. Then it turns into Democratic activists. And one of the big stories of American politics is the movement of African-American voters into the Democratic Party, starting around the 40s, maybe a little bit earlier, but the 40s for sure. And now they're firmly there. But now we're seeing a little bit of erosion, where interestingly, Trump has actually reclaimed some of those votes a little bit. And that is what is fueling some of his swing state victories.
I wanted to ask a question about education, because Dr. Grant talked about how her organization is about educating people. And I want you to educate us, Fabio Rojas, about polling. How accurate are the polls these days? There are a lot of stories, a lot of news stories about polling. But polling is it's a different animal than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. How has it changed? Has it gotten more accurate, less accurate?
Yeah, so the answer is there's a lot of good news. Mm-hmm. Polling has become a lot better. We don't have catastrophes like we had in the past. So there have been famous cases where polls have been wrong because we only called people on the phone. And in the 1950s, not everybody had a phone, right? There's some challenges like that today. So, for example, even if everybody has a cell phone, a lot of people don't answer the phone. So as a response, pollsters have not taken this sitting down. They've actually developed a lot of different tools to kind of come up with different ways to measure what the population thinks at a particular period of time. So, for example, some organizations like Ipsos, that's a big polling organization, they maintain a panel, a representative panel of Americans that they can poll periodically that they know will pick up the phone and is representative. Also, what you can do is once you get the numbers, you can adjust them. So if you know a certain group doesn't vote as much as another group, you can adjust the numbers to give you a projection. And so often the public will say, well, you know, the polls are atrocious because maybe my candidate isn't winning them, or it was kind of off base in one election. But there's been a lot of study of this. And when you look at a lot of polls over a lot of elections, they tend to do a good job and just take into account that is a guesstimate based on a survey of a few hundred people. So don't expect perfect precision, but if you want to be in the ballpark, it's actually not bad.
It's also about a point in time.
Yes, right? That is correct.
Right.
So, for example, zero people – well, not zero, but maybe single-digit number of people will vote for Joe Biden now, right? And that changed over a week, like a complete collapse. I'm sure somebody will vote for Biden, but not many people will vote. Presumably, people will vote for Vice President Harris at this point if they're Democrats.
Right, right. We were talking before the program started about the accuracy of polling in general, and you said very much what you were saying now about it's actually pretty good. But I think you also commented that at the state level, it starts to get a little wonky.
Oh, yeah.
So can you say more about kind of state level polling?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is probably very important for this election in particular, because most polls indicate that Vice President Harris and former President Trump are within a few points of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So they're tied. The best polling averages show Trump ahead by about 3 points, and maybe some of that is being clawed back with Harris, right? But that's not the game you have to win. You have to win the Electoral College. And so then you have to ask, well, what do the polls in the different states say? And you're correct that polling at the state level is not as reliable as at the national level, because it's hard to know whether somebody really lives in a particular state and whether they're really registered in a certain state. So the people who pick up the phone may or may not be from Wisconsin or Minnesota or North Carolina, or one of these states that swing. So the polls there aren't atrocious. I don't want to give that impression. But there's a little bit more volatility. You have to take them with a little bit of grain of salt, which is why you have to repeatedly poll to get a good sense of what's happening at the state level.
Brian Howie, I want to go back to the question I asked you earlier about whether there would be with the new dynamics of this race, whether there'd be any effect on the other Indiana races, the down ballot races?
Well, I'm waiting to see. After the news broke on Sunday, and then the Divine Nine inspired massive fundraising call, I think Sunday night, my wife was on a similar call for white ladies last night, and it raised several million dollars. In 2022 was the first post-Dobbs election, and not a single Republican in the General Assembly who voted for some of the most, comprehensive abortion restrictions in the country lost. And there were some good candidates. There was a Notre Dame professor that had filed against Representative Dale Devon up in the Elkhart area. She did not win. So now I'm waiting to see whether the Kamala Harris tide, lifts boats down ballot. I think that remains to be seen at this point.
Well, as we know, Indiana is a very strong red state. Usually it's the first state called for the Republican president, or a lot of times it is. When you look at some of the down ballot races, I'm just curious about the races for governor or for Senate. What is the polling showing on those races at this point?
Well, I haven't seen any head-to-heads between Mike Braun, the Republican nominee, and Jennifer McCormick, so that remains to be seen. The maps that are so gerrymandered here in Indiana that there's only one congressional district, the first congressional district that is even competitive, and then Indiana Democrats have their goal is to pick up four seats in the General Assembly to end the House supermajority. And again, the maps are just daunting. They're very Republican centric, and it may take a movement that Kamala Harris ignites in order to for the Democratic Party in Indiana to make some gains this November.
Although that shouldn't affect directly the gubernatorial or Senate races, right? I mean, those will be decided at the state level.
Yeah, those are statewide races.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you know, McCormick, she's sitting on about 700,000 cash on hand, which is a pretty, that's a pretty minuscule number considering that Mike Braun will probably spend $15 to $20 million. But if Jennifer McCormick can ride the tide of a lot of female voters inspired by Kamala Harris's candidacy, and then if she can also tap into the reservoir of teachers, retired educators, and that kind of thing, that's how Glenda Ritz won the state superintendent of public instruction race in 2012. She was outspent 10-1, but she relied on a movement to get there. So that's what I'm waiting to see, is whether this movement of females changes the dynamic here in a red state like Indiana.
Yeah. Dr. Grant, can you talk about the issues that are of importance to, you know, I know you're a nonpartisan group, but what are the issues that are important to your sorority, or your Greek letter organization?
Yes, absolutely. So as I shared before, our focus on social justice, health justice, and economic justice, what does that mean? It means equity and access to the needs of our community. For instance, we have one of the longest standing partnerships over 50 years with the March of Dimes as we address the challenges with maternal health. And we also expanded our work with birth equity and the ways in which we see the disparities in the communities that we serve for those who need care as mothers. The Momnibus Act is an act that we were pushing for information and mobilization around that bill being passed that breaks down just simple access that mothers should be able to have living in this wonderful country of opportunities. When we think about the social justice piece, the ability to be able to register to vote freely without intimidation and voter suppression, looking at the ways in which we we are continuing to support efforts around managing the violence in communities and also looking at the policing and what does that mean and how do we turn to community policing opportunities, right? The ways in which our members feel safe and feel protected. And we have members who serve on the force. So we know what respect comes with that particular area, but opening up for conversations around healthy de-escalation activities and programs that come to communities to help decrease violence. When we think about the affordable way in which those with diabetes can get insulin, that's important to our communities. When we think about the economic justice, how are small businesses having access to capital and opportunity to create legacy wealth for their families? So we stay on the ground each and every day as an organization doing community needs assessments. How can we best serve the particular area of focus for that chapter? And our chapters are broken down into cities and towns throughout the different states in the United States and the over 7 or 8 countries where we occupy service lens. So with that, when we listen to what the return is for this particular administration, we want to say, well, how have seniors benefited? How has the education system been improved? How can we look towards opportunities for growth and development with new franchises, new small business owners because of the work that the SBA is doing, for an example? So we also have the administrator for SBA coming to speak tonight, actually, at our closing banquet because of our partnership with the SBA. So we're always looking to assess the needs in our community, see where there's shortfall, lack of equity and access, and create the advocacy, the information, and the mobilization to get change and transformation where required and necessary.
I want to turn, we're coming up to the hour, and I want to turn to maybe a more general question about the presidential campaign that we don't need to repeat, but of course we're in an incredibly polarized time. And Fabio, as you mentioned earlier, party identification is stronger now than it's been in quite a long time. And so both presidential candidates obviously have to think about how they're going to appeal to the majority and you know, in some way bridge some of that gap. I note at the RNC, President Trump did say, I'm running to be president of all of America, not half of America. And obviously, Kamala Harris now has to also convince people. I think I should go on to say, just noting what Steve Shine said earlier about the things that appeal to Allen County Republicans are particular to a particular base that Trump has been able to attract. So hard to see how that's going to translate to the whole country. I'd be interested, both Brian and Fabio, if you could just speak to what you see, how you see both President Trump and Vice President Harris addressing that issue of polarization and trying to appeal to voters who have not traditionally been supporting them.
Yeah, so you could start by looking at what the words are and what the rhetoric are. And both candidates certainly like to say they're appealing to the whole country. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that that former President Trump actually went to third parties. He spoke at the Libertarian Convention and told them to vote for him, right? But still, then the question remains, what are the actual policies or things that you would give to certain constituencies to really get them to switch their votes, right? And so looking at the Trump's campaign's activities, I would say that they're still gunning for the base to come out. In a polarized world where people are sorted into Democrat and Republican boxes, there's not a lot of independent voters in between. So nominating J.D. Vance, as our earlier guest said, just really energized the base. But it's kind of difficult to see how somebody with his socially conservative agenda would appeal to the quote-unquote soccer moms of the world or the suburban – I mean, that's an old school term, but we already mentioned that block of voters as being pivotal for some people. And then Kamala Harris, reading some of the remarks she delivered to Zeta Phi Beta, she's really focusing on things like reproductive access. And as people noted, that was surprisingly strong after Dobbs, and that even surprised me a little bit how strong of an issue that became. So she may not be bridging the gap, but she is getting at least one issue that will spread outside of the Democratic box into female voters in the Republican box and pull them in. Then beyond that, I think Kamala Harris really does rely on a lot of kind of basic Democratic Party platform issues. So, for example, she believes in increasing corporate taxes to the level they were in previous administrations. She believes in a lot of these policies that really speak back to the kind of Democratic core.
And thematically, she's first of all, I think Kamala Harris has come out of the gates about as strong as any presidential campaign candidate has in my memory. And she's, I think she's articulating two basic themes. One is, you know, Republicans are going backwards, i.e. Donald Trump seems to be obsessed with the, quote, stolen election of 2020, whereas Democrats are going forward. And the other thing is, you know, her comment about she knows Donald Trump's type. She's basically positioning herself as the prosecutor versus the felon kind of thing. And that's going to be fascinating to see. And then finally, in 2017, I had the opportunity to have dinner with J.D. Vance and Mitch Daniels up at Purdue when he was promoting his book, Hillbilly Elegy. And one of the things that J.D. Vance told me at the time was that he felt that in the next 20 or 30 years, there is going to be a political realignment, and that he even said that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are likely to end up in the same party. And then we've seen Congressman Banks basically shift the Republican Party from, you know, the corporate country club cast to more of the working class thing. And so it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out this November.
All right. We've got a lot to watch for, but we are out of time today. So I want to thank Dr. Stacey Grant. Thank you for joining us today from your convention. I hope you enjoy the rest of your time in Indianapolis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the discussion. I think that's what impresses me the most about our country. When we can have rich dialogue, we can disagree or agree, but we can do it in a civil way and make sure we're concerned about the people of the United States of America. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you to Brian Howie for joining us. Always great to have you on the show, Brian. And Professor Fabio Rojas, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate that. For Lori McRobbie, our producer, Benta Boutier, and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.